We are listener-supported. One Radio Network.
Turn my microphone on. That would help. A very pleasant good morning to you. It is November 16, 2020, as we are live here on OneRadioNetwork.com. You're watching on YouTube. You can put up your questions there. Sharon monitors that for us. Or simply email patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. Sorry, the 800 thing is not working this morning. It's just not. So just the email is where we're going to go. Patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. We're going to talk about the Constitution and what could be going on constitutionally with an expert on the Constitution, Richard Proctor, a former member, or still is, the Constitutional Party. He knows his stuff. And we'll be speaking to him on a couple ideas of the election and all that, but also the constitutionality of different governors and mayors telling you to do this or that, and also the constitutionality about potential vaccines and forcing people to take stuff or forcing you to take a test, you know, stuff like that. So I think you'll find the show interesting. Have a couple of the people that are going to be on this week too that have yet to totally confirm, but kind of a poetry in motion for this week. So stay tuned. Let us know how we can help. My email is always here, patrick@oneradionetwork.com. The email reaches me, and then we'll talk with you and take care of you the best we can do. On the third Monday of the month, which is today, Dr. Ray Peete joins us around this time, or a little bit late, as we said. Generally, we try to start about 10. Well, you know, it doesn't matter. We're here now. Dr. Ray Peete, interesting fellow, very well-respected PhD researcher in the field of health and nutrition. Got his PhD up in the University of Oregon, where he still lives today, specializing in physiology. He started his work with hormones in 1968. His website is raypeete.com, and you can sign up for a newsletter by Ray Peete's newsletters, Ray Peete's newsletter at gmail.com. Dr. Peete, did I have that right? Is it Ray Peete's newsletter? Is that it?
With an S, Ray Peete's, but no apostrophe.
Yeah, just Ray Peete's newsletter, right, at gmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
How are you doing, sir, up there in Oregon? How are things?
Oh, it's very dim and rainy and cloudy and alternating cold. But that's a normal winter in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. You do well with the you've lived up there a long time. Obviously, your body must do well with this the weather there.
Yeah, the humidity is generally moderate. I lived for a while in the mountains of Montana, and indoors the humidity goes to just about absolute zero.
Yeah.
From here down to central Mexico, there's a comfortable amount of humidity, which I like, but I would like more sun and warmth.
Yeah. We've often heard over the years that it's good to have some humidity. It helps to elimination in the colon and all of that. Do people that live in the desert have issues with that and get too dry?
Yeah, in the high desert. I lived in New Mexico for a while, and the people there at about 6,000 feet altitude and lots of sun, almost no rain or snow there, but the constant high-altitude sun and fair amount of dryness, their skin tends to get prematurely aged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do people with more sun near the equator, do they generally have better health markers and longevity, do we know? Any research on that?
And altitude is even more important than the steady sunlight. But degenerative diseases, multiple sclerosis was one of the first things they noticed very little of it towards the equator, and farther north you get the deficiency of ultraviolet, and vitamin D ends up with all of the inflammatory degenerative diseases, rheumatoid arthritis, and nerve disease.
What do you suppose the altitude, Dr. Pete? What does that do? What's going on?
That really is one of the most neglected areas of health research, but the insurance companies were wise to it 120 years ago or more, that the degenerative diseases, cancer and heart disease, are about 10% lower chronically in all of the high cities of the world. And in 1959, in his book, Linus Pauling saw those figures, and he was concentrating on radiation mutations causing cancer, and he saw those old figures showing that cancer mortality decreases steadily as you go up in altitude. He couldn't believe it. He said, something must be wrong with those figures. But it turns out someone reading his book in Texas compared the amount that they figured that melanoma would be the most responsive to the high infrared, high ultraviolet light at high altitude. So this person made a map of the state and comparing the altitude and the mortality from melanoma, and found that even within the moderate altitude range of Texas, that there is much less melanoma at higher altitudes, much more at lower altitudes. So it definitely isn't just ultraviolet radiation causing mutations. The increased vitamin D at altitude is one of the anti-cancer, anti-aging factors. But the apart from the vitamin D, at altitude, many other things change. Within, I think it was Bolivia, two cities were compared, one at around 13,500 feet altitude, one around 4,000 feet, not low altitude, but even within that 9,000-foot difference, there were eight times as many 100-year-old people in a city of the same population at high altitude. Just a vast difference in extreme longevity for the high altitude. And within New Mexico, every 1,000 feet higher you go, you see lower death rate from heart disease. And the best understood factor that changes with altitude when you're adapted is that your carbon dioxide rises with altitude, and the higher the carbon dioxide is, the less lactic acid your cells produce. And lactic acid metabolism is characteristic of stress, typical of cancer metabolism, but also heart disease and other inflammatory conditions.
Interesting. So it's that idea with breathing properly, like not over-breathing, which you've heard of the Buteyko method kind of talks about, where we retain more high carbon dioxide and we can hold our breath essentially longer. That's reducing lactic acid, right?
Right. Breathing in a paper bag, I've seen people lower their blood pressure in a day just by every half hour or so. Breathing for about a minute in a paper bag. And the blood pressure comes down because of the carbon dioxide displacing inflammatory lactic acid.
Huh. Dr. Ray Peters with us. We have lots of questions already for you, so we're going to dig right in so we don't get behind here. And this is a great place to start because I was going to kind of ask you this anyway, so we'll use Mark's email, Dr. Pete, to get into this. Dr. Pete, I'm beginning to believe that this whole China virus idea is not true. Now we are hearing more and more talk about mandatory vaccines and more lockdowns. He has two questions. What do you think, after all this time, this COVID virus is about, if you would? And secondly, God forbid, if it would come to it, mandatory vaccines, could we take anything to limit the damage? So that's a good place to start. I mean, we've been looking at this, Dr. Pete, for what? Gosh, close to a year, well, 9 months or so. And I'm sure you've done plenty of your own research and your knowledge about viruses, the germ theory or not, exosomes. What is your take on what we are experiencing, your opinion?
In the fall and winter of 2019, the Chinese identified the coronavirus that was associated with pneumonia. But very quickly, they found that there were five variations of that virus, indicating that it had been around and mutating for a while. And then once they had the PCR test to identify it, the people around the world started checking stored samples, and a batch of sewage, I think it was in Portugal, from January of 2019, about a year before the Chinese virus, the coronavirus was identified in Portuguese sewage a year earlier. So it definitely didn't just originate. By the time it got to China, there were always already at least five varieties. And that rate of mutation indicates that by now, almost a year later, we would expect to have about 25 variants of the virus.
25.
And that's the reason, after about 70 years of trying, I guess 80 years of trying to make a vaccine against the common cold, that they found it was impossible because the coronavirus mutates so fast. So the reason we don't have vaccines for common cold would suggest that there will never be a vaccine that is actually effective for the coronavirus. But if you look at what happened with the polio vaccine, the polio was identified as certain kinds of paralysis.
Mm-hmm.
And so every time, for 50 years, there was accumulating evidence that polio-like paralysis coincided with the use of the hypodermic needle for intramuscular injections. And it was confirmed in animal studies as well as continuing into Africa that the part of the body that receives the intramuscular vaccine is very likely to be the limb that is paralyzed, showing that it's the intramuscular injection causing the paralysis. But despite that, they came out with a polio vaccine, and suddenly the incidence of paralytic polio dropped sharply, so that the vaccine was confirmed to work. But oddly, the incidence of other types of paralysis, similar actual paralytic symptoms, were given a new name, Guillain-Barre, and myelitis, transverse myelitis, and several other types of paralysis suddenly shot up right after the introduction of the polio vaccine. So by changing the definition, you can make a vaccine seem to work very efficiently. And in the case of COVID, since when the great peak of COVID incidence and mortality appeared in the second week of April of this year, there was the incidence of influenza had fell off a cliff. Very strongly indicated that what they had called influenza, suddenly the definition changed, ending the influenza epidemic and creating this huge peak in COVID. So we can expect once the vaccine comes into use, there will be an instruction instead of saying that a cough and a fever of 100 degrees are the symptoms that will have you written down as a COVID patient. They'll simply change the return to a rational way of diagnosing COVID, make it a little more restrictive, and suddenly the COVID cases will disappear.
Oh, because they'll change the definition of what a COVID case is, and then they'll say the vaccine worked.
Right.
But in your opinion, with all your research, and you're over 80 years old now, you can't really create a vaccine for a virus. They've never been able to do it, correct?
For a very stable kind of virus like smallpox.
Possibly.
It works pretty well for smallpox, so they could eliminate the disease by surrounding the areas where it was outbreaking and vaccinate people in a circle. That is simply not in their plans. If the vaccines worked, they could circle an outbreak and quarantine the sick people and their immediate contacts eliminate the virus quickly if the vaccine worked.
So some viruses don't mutate like the corona, like the smallpox, and that's why it's possible to actually literally isolate the smallpox and electron microscope, and you could actually see it and then thus create a vaccine, which is the theory behind vaccines?
The smallpox virus is a DNA virus. The coronavirus is an RNA, and they're extremely unstable.
RNA viruses are unstable. So these coronaviruses, are they're always running around and mutating in the world, just always, and they're cold? People experience colds and flus from them?
And if a very sick old person catches a cold, it's not uncommon for just a common cold to kill someone who
sure.
is older.
Right. The body. So then am I hearing you saying that this thing that went on was no more different than any other RNA virus that runs around?
I and a few other people started looking at the actual numbers back in February and March of this year, we couldn't see that anything at all was happening.
Right.
It's only a few people early who were saying that, but by now, looking back at the actual figures, more and more people are recognizing that nothing happened. There was no pandemic.
No pandemic. So now, as you know, and our audience knows, more, especially near you in the state of Washington, they're having all these cases, right, which are just positive tests, which we'll get to, and they're actually canceling Thanksgiving up in Washington. You can't do it, and maybe Christmas. And Dr. Fauci's talking about, I saw a video from a CNN clip, you know, CNN, and he's saying, well, we're probably not going to be able to get back to normal till maybe the third quarter in 2021. So it looks like the forces, Dr. Pete, behind this want to really run this baby for a long time, I guess, geopolitically, politically, financially, that we won't get into. But if they're basing the cases on a PCR test, somebody sent me a thing, Dr. Pete, that says Kerry Mullins invented the PCR test that's being used, and he said his PCR test was not made to detect any type of infectious disease. Is that true?
And he said that he designed it to be used for a maximum number of cycles.
Cycles, yes.
34 cycles, I think he said.
Yes.
He said beyond that, it becomes meaningless because it produces more and more random results. But Fauci ordered them to run 40 cycles. You're much more likely to have a false positive when you run it beyond its designed capacity.
Yes, let's talk about that. We actually have a video that we played, and we could play it again. I don't know if it's necessary. In July, Dr. Fauci saying anything above a 30 to 35 cycles, and Eli said, I like 30. Anything, you're just getting dead nucleotides.
Right.
So what is a dead nucleotide? So tell folks what a cycle is. They're spinning the blood after they're spinning the thing they get from your nose. They spin it so many times?
The virus itself is enclosed in a bunch of proteins like any of our exosomes. But the unique RNA that can be identified is enclosed in that protein circle. Sphere. If your immune system has started tearing apart that virus, the virus no longer is infective, so you can call it dead. And so you just have scraps of material. But all the PCR needs is to have a scrap of RNA, and that will identify the virus, even though you might have 100 scraps for every active virus.
And we've read that most places are spinning between 40 to 45 around the country. Do you think that's accurate?
I think that's true, but it's a certain way to create false positives.
Of course.
Create cases that don't exist.
So these cases, if you're spinning at 40, as Fauci said himself, above 30 is dead nucleotides. they don't necessarily mean that somebody has a live, active, virulent, potentially deadly virus, right? They just don't, do they?
Almost all of the viruses that come into existence just end up as random dust fragments, one of 100 different molecules can be identified as viral RNA, but it has no infective power at all.
So what do you say when these viruses come to an existence? Do they just kind of erupt as living organisms? Are they living? Are they alive?
They are structurally and functionally very similar to our own exosomes
that, right?
Our cells, under stress, emit particles that are intended to communicate between tissues. For example, if you have lung inflammation, exosomes will be put into the bloodstream and go to the bone marrow, the bone marrow will recognize a problem in lung cells and make repair cells. But the virus is similar to RNA or DNA fragments that are turned into exosomes, and so once it gets caught into a cell, the cell can multiply it in proportion to the stress it's experiencing. So a healthy cell can receive a virus, and it's not making exosomes, so it probably won't make virus particles either. But once it gets into this stressed cell producing exosome-like particles, the virus can get spewed out into the bloodstream and lungs as a potentially infective virus.
So when you say stress could be anything from fear, worry, chemical, any kind of thing, really bad food?
Malnutrition.
Malnutrition, yeah. Whatever. And the body would create these exosomes to communicate with parts of the body to help it to heal?
To restore balance in the different parts of the body.
Right. And these exosomes look exactly like a coronavirus. Is that correct? I've seen pictures.
Under an electron microscope, it's essentially impossible to tell the difference.
Possible. So there are many people that are arguing, not many, but a handful, that this whole thing is just about exosomes and there's not any really coronavirus out there there. But you're not one of those. You still believe that there's still... You tell me.
We've had colds forever. This is just another variation of that family of viruses.
When you say we've had colds forever, is the body just going through some kind of healing detox when we experience a cold, or do we catch it from out there?
It's in all of the studies over the last 70 or 80 years, they have found that it's extremely hard to deliberately pass a cold. You have to...
It's impossible almost, isn't it?
Almost, yeah. You have to get a person to lie down with their head slightly lower, and then take the mucus from the nose of someone who is extremely infected and drip it right into their nose, and then some of those people will come down with the virus. But just sitting around all day, for example, in a small room with some infected people and others not infected, there's almost no chance of it actually passing by casual contact, such as playing cards. They have put a dye in the nose of one person playing cards, after playing cards for a while, the dye from one person's nose is going to end up on everyone's hands and face.
Yes.
Even though there is contact and spreading of material, it just happens that it's very seldom that that kind of contact is going to spread a cold.
Or a flu. Similar.
So if a person is already starting to get sick, then they're the ones who will find a virus and incubate it and come down with something.
So in general, these colds and flus are not really we're not being assaulted from something other than ourselves, generally.
You have to be somewhat sick and stressed before you come down with any of these potentially infective things.
Do we change exosomes with one another?
Since the 1940s, there's been a lot of investigation of that subject and finding that it goes across species and families and phyla, the most distant organism, like tree pollen. The DNA from tree pollen can get into our bodies.
So if you if you exchange an exosome with me and you've overcome something, would that help me to do the same thing? Is that the idea of sharing information?
Bacteria are known to do that.
Yeah.
You expose one batch of bacteria to penicillin, and those that manage to survive it have constructed enzymes that break down penicillin. It works on practically anything in the environment. The surviving bacteria can pass in an exosome, can pass this particle to not only members of their species, but even very different types of bacteria. It requires a conjugation in the case of bacteria, as far as is known. They send out a little tube to the other bacterium and pass the genes across that tube.
Would that be similar? This could be way off track, Doc, but the idea that even cockroaches can become immune to a chemical very quickly, and their kids, you know, you could spray them with the same chemical and it doesn't hurt them. Are they doing similar kind of thing?
I think so. The bacteria have been very well studied, there is great resistance because of the idea of genetic determinism and genes being eternal until they're mutated, losing function. But the idea of acquiring information, that was called Lamarckism, and was outlawed. They fired high school and college teachers who talked about Lamarckism starting in 1946 and 7. They weeded it out entirely from the United States. But the idea was sustained by three or four genetics people around the world, and came back as epigenetics the transgenerational transmission of acquired information and so on. So the whole Lamarck thing it was politically, philosophically rejected, but scientifically the evidence has gradually forced its way back, and still the professors generally get very angry if you try to say that all of these new facts are confirming Lamarck. They're saying no, it's something very different, but it acts exactly the way Lamarckism predicted that they would work out.
And Lamarckism, the basic premise is, again, to be clear?
Darwin himself asserted that it happened, that an acquired adaptive trait, something that the organism learns to do, or to be immune to, or resist, that can be passed on to the offspring. Darwin proposed that there were gemmules created by every cell containing, describing its abilities, and that these gemmules formed during the life of an individual traveled through the bloodstream to the gonads and entered the germ cells, passing on acquired information. That was Darwin himself refining Lamarck's general idea. With neo-Darwinism, Darwin himself was censored, genes became unchangeable things. That, for example, a very stupid series of experiments in Germany. Cutting off, I think it was 1,200 mouse tails, and then showing that no mice were born with amputated tails.
That's how they were going to disprove this idea.
It had nothing to do with what either Darwin or Lamarck had proposed. Just an insane experiment, but people were still citing that in university when I was there. A really demented sort of logic.
So it's similar in a way to, I think, what has been termed, Dr. Ray Pete, as sins of the fathers, where we also pass on a lot of fragments of things like leprosy and herpes and God knows what, right? Syphilis. We've done quite a few shows on root canals, and they've had peer-reviewed studies with my dentist, who's done a peer-reviewed studies, and they'll find all these different crazy bacterial things in the root canals that are infected, like leprosy, as I said, and syphilis and herpes. And these things are just, they must just be running around in all of our bodies at some, or fragments, or what are they?
They do circulate harmlessly.
Harmlessly.
If you're in good health.
Hmm. But they're in there.
Sometimes, not always.
Not always. Huh. And we might pass these along to baby?
Sometimes, yeah. If the general health is very bad,
mm-hmm.
the emphasis tended to be on denying that anything was inheritable or acquired from the environment, and so it all had to be genetic. So all of the effects of malnutrition, poverty, all of these effects were blamed on bad genes.
Hmm.
For example, until just 20 or 30 years ago, the dogma medically was that eclampsia, seizures during pregnancy,
mm-hmm.
hypertension during pregnancy, premature birth, damaged babies, and so on, all this was absolutely genetic, that the baby had bad genes that were causing the eclampsia in the mother. So the doctor had no responsibility to cure their bad inheritance, they were denying that nutrition could have anything to do with prematurity and pregnancy problems because of the absolute genetic determinism. Starting with a few doctors like Tom Brewer, he showed that if you give women a reasonable amount of protein, a slightly more expensive diet, and don't restrict their salt or anything they crave, you absolutely prevent eclampsia and tremendously reduce birth defects and prematurity and so on.
So they completely wiped out, not completely, but it wiped out the genetic determinism idea.
Yeah.
What we call epigenetics now, we change it because of our lifestyle.
The genetic determinism was used to maintain class differences and keep people in poverty.
Hmm. So oftentimes when folks go to the doctors, which we don't recommend, but they do, they fill out all these forms, and you'll fill out something like, did your mom or dad had diabetes or heart attack or stuff like that? Is there anything to that?
In Israel, that was scientifically put to rest.
Was it?
Because they were still believing that diabetes was inherited. But you had the immigrants from Europe into Israel brought the European diabetes incidents with them. But the North African Jews who came into the country had zero diabetes when they came to Israel, and their children, starting to eat the European diet, developed a European rate of diabetes, showing that it was absolutely environmental, zero determination by genes.
Mm-hmm. So that could be why, if one puts too much stock in what do they call them, like 23andMe and these things, that could lead you down black holes that you don't need to go?
Yeah, genes and viruses both have been used for the last 120 years as an excuse for why you can't make someone well. The doctor says, oh, it's a virus. We don't have an antibiotic to cure viruses, or it's a gene. It's hopeless. But instead of giving them a good diet, vitamin supplements, or whatever it takes.
Dr. Ray Pete, stay right there, sir. We got a little late start, so we'd like to keep you a little bit longer if we can, if you're okay with it. We have lots of emails. We're going to do whatever we can to get to as many as we can. And so stay right there. Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. This is very interesting technology. See what you think. Previously, with Dr. Mark Serkis, he offered this.
The audience should know both of us are into hydrogen, and specifically hydrogen inhalation. Both are into the same machine. This guy, George, the AquaCure, made in New York and Canada. So 3 months ago, a study that was published in Dove Press, brain metastasis completely disappear in non-small cell lung cancer using hydrogen gas inhalation.
We're not saying that breathing hydrogen and drinking hydrogen water will cure your cancer. Not at all. We're just reporting on a study. But just imagine what breathing hydrogen is doing for my body and can be doing for yours, bringing things back into balance. The AquaCure Hydrogen Brown's Gas Machine, we think the best on the market. Use promo code ONERADIO, a 1 year, no questions asked, money back guarantee, lifetime warranty. The AquaCure Hydrogen Brown's Gas Machine, promo code ONERADIO, 10% discount on OneRadioNetwork.com. Yeah, it's a really excellent technology. You can drink the water as we do, or breathe the gas, the Brown's gas. And you can go to MolecularHydrogenInstitute.com and see just hundreds and hundreds of peer-reviewed studies. So there's something going on with this. Again, we're not making any kind of claims about it at all. But if it is the antioxidant that many, many studies have proven it to be, there's just no telling what your body would be able to do, well, you know, once you get happy with it and working with it. Use promo code ONERADIO on OneRadioNetwork.com. Previously, with chemist, biologist, and nutritionist George Altgelt, we asked him this. And so what do you think about Dr. Seneff's contention that as these glyphosates are in the soil, they bust the sulfur cycle, and that's really detrimental to the body?
It's extremely detrimental. Sulfur is such an important detoxifying agent for the entire body, and especially for the liver. Got to have trace minerals so that the liver can build these compounds that are essential for getting itself cleaned. And that lady who was talking about sulfur, man, play that ad every chance you get, because our foods are so deficient in sulfur, and it is a big deal for the liver to have enough sulfur to make all those compounds that it uses to detoxify itself. Not just sulfur. They're all important, but sulfur is the one that we're so deficient in, and we need sulfur.
Thanks, George. I had some this morning. You might want to give it a try. You can click an order right on the front page of OneRadioNetwork.com. 3 locations, 3 prices delivered. And if you like more than £4 for a discount, email me, Patrick, at OneRadioNetwork.com. Oh, that's me. We are going to do, I'll tell you later. We mentioned Stephanie Seneff. She has been looking at this potential vaccine that's going to be coming out, and there's some pretty very, very interesting, curious things that could be in this baby, and so stay tuned for that. Sign up to our YouTube channel, subscribe, click the bell just to the right, and then you'll be notified every time we do a stream like this with Dr. Pete and other people on YouTube. So you just want to stay in touch, and we'll keep you as well informed and entertained as we can. If I don't lose my voice.
We are listener-supported, One Radio Network.
We're talking with Dr. Ray Pete. He is here on the third Monday of the month, and his website is raypete.com. Raypete.com. You can do Ray Pete's newsletter at gmail.com, and I think that comes out every couple of months. Well, Dara, we better get to the emails because I could just talk to you all day long, and that's not fair. We have so many emails here. Here's one for you, Dr. Pete. I thought I heard Dr. Pete once say that he maybe would order, an empanada if he went out to a Mexican restaurant. I thought empanadas were made with wheat flour and wondered if Dr. Pete might occasionally think it's okay to eat foods made with wheat flour from Cynthia.
No, I don't. About 50 years ago, the industry started pushing wheat on the Mexican population, and they started introducing it into tortillas. Wheat tortilla is a horrible thing. The unleavened wheat, especially, is toxic, worse than even the well leavened bread. If it has been processed by a sourdough method, that breaks down many of the toxins. But a wheat empanada or wheat tortilla is just a horrible thing.
Just not a good thing. You've talked about the nixtamalization of the corn, and you can get that now and make your tortillas and that. Do you think the corn is relatively nutritious enough food to even go through that, you know, that effort to get a good nixtamalization corn? I mean, is it worth it?
Well, the plain corn, as was eaten throughout the southern United States, it has a toxic excess of leucine. And it contains no niacin to speak of. And nixtamalizing it reduces the toxic amount of leucine and tremendously increases the amount of niacin.
Mm-hmm.
And it adds a lot of calcium. So that in a kilogram of tortillas, you've got an amount of calcium that is almost like a quart of milk.
Wow. So it doesn't matter what kind of corn. Well, of course, we'd want it to be organic if possible, but the nixtamalization really ramps up the nutritional profile of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Good. Cool. Dr. Pete, this is Eve, and she's in Stockholm, Sweden. Hi, Eve. Wants to know, could you ask Dr. Pete how menopausal women can get rid of endometrial polyps?
The ideal way would be to have a menstruation. But the anti-estrogen tamoxifen,
yes.
It has enough estrogenic effects that it tremendously increases the risk of endometrial polyps. And I think the restoration of a physiological cycle, even if it doesn't succeed in menstruation, but if you correct your thyroid, vitamin D, calcium intake, that's going to shift the balance favorably away from estrogen, and it's the unopposed estrogen that leads to the polyps.
Okay. All right. Back to that again. Excellent. Do you think that the vitamin D blood tests are accurate at all to go by if you're getting enough sun or vitamin D?
Yeah, they're pretty good. A few years ago, one of the companies was doing horribly inaccurate tests, but when they were exposed, they improved their methods. And so I think now the average hospital at a moderate price should be $30 to $50 mm-hmm. per test.
Is there a number on the D that you'd like to see or research shows that is adequate?
Yeah, 50 nanograms.
How many?
550.
Oh, 50 nanograms.
Per milliliter.
Which is the number they normally show, right? That's the number they're showing, nanograms per milliliter.
Lots of people, the worse their symptoms are, the farther they are below 30.
Is there a difference between getting it internally or out in the sun?
Quite a bit of difference. The ultraviolet light does age your skin, so you don't want to get sunburned. But once your vitamin D level is up as a result of sunshine, then you're getting many other internal benefits from the bright sunlight.
Good stuff, yeah.
Because the other wavelengths, especially red light, neutralize and detoxify the aging effects of the ultraviolet. Mm-hmm. So you get side effects other than the vitamin D mm-hmm. if you get sunlight.
On these red lights, there's all different kinds. You can get various wavelength of a red light, 600, 700, 800, or just the chicken lamps, you know, from Home Depot. Are bodies like this red light?
The chicken lamps are very good because they have the usable, more or less full spectrum white looking light and provide heat, red light, and the cheery brightness itself is very important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Here is John wants to know, does Dr. Pete, his opinion on inversion therapy, is it safe and effective?
Inversion?
Inversion, yeah. I guess flipping over on your head.
Oh, that.
Yeah.
No, I don't think it's especially beneficial.
You don't think it's beneficial? Okay. Here is from Kirby. What is the best carbohydrate to protein ratio?
It depends on your age, largely. The older you are, the more you have to be careful about excess protein. High protein diet can seriously suppress your thyroid function. And the average normal protein is high in methionine and cysteine. And too much of those greatly accelerate the aging process. So after the age of 40, you have to carefully watch the balance between the amount of protein in your diet and the nutrients, calcium, vitamin D, and your thyroid function. The carbohydrate can have a very reviving therapeutic effect. Currently, I'm hearing reports from several people who by introducing fruit juice or even Mexican Coca-Cola, suddenly they recovered from various things, depression, migraines, all signs of slowing inhibited metabolism.
Sugar.
Sugar, yeah.
Good old sugar. Yeah, you could actually, I think you can actually still get Mexican Coca-Cola. I think there's a place in Dripping Springs, and you can actually get it where it has sugar rather than high fructose corn syrup in it.
Yeah, it's becoming so popular that supermarkets...
They're figuring it out, right?
Are selling it out quickly, and that's so they're funny. Going... I think it might convince the U.S. Coca-Cola company to return to producing some proper Coke.
Yeah, but I can't imagine, I guess, what the price would be to change on your cost analysis by changing from high fructose corn syrup to sugar. I bet you'd be, you know, over billions of bottles, probably be a big expense for the Coca-Cola company to do it. I don't know.
But if they see sales shifting to expensive imported Coke, they could do it more economically than having to import the stuff.
Mm-hmm. Here's an email. You've talked about orange juice before, but what about other fruits, writes an emailer, like apples and peaches and berries and melons?
If they're well ripened, they can be extremely valuable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Currently, what you find in supermarkets, most of them are poorly ripened.
Yeah. George wants to know, do you think there are some rices that are more appropriate, better than other rices? There's so many varieties of rices, my goodness.
I think white rice is the best because the germ and the bran age and oxidize and get rancid. The Chinese learned that white rice doesn't go bad in storage, doesn't get rancid.
Is that right? Well, so that would be like a jasmine or just a basmati white rice, something like that?
Any white rice means it's been polished and had the bran and germ removed.
Sophie wants to know, Dr. Pete, does sprouting beans and grains make them safe to eat or just less evil? Okay, are they good for us or are they just less evil?
It at least doubles the usable protein. So if you're eating beans for protein, cooked sprouts are going to give you a more survivable amount of protein, where the bean as usually cooked is a very, very poor source of protein with more toxin value. But the problem with sprouts is they have to be well cooked. You don't want raw sprouts in your salad because generally sprouts can release a lot of anti-thyroid material.
Ah, so as long as you cook them, you're pretty good. You're okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Another David, would a silica-based clay like Rhassoul, Rhassoul, be okay to use topically?
Topically, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever use these clays internally or recommend them? Or?
Oh, never.
Never?
Because stomach acid will dissolve some heavy metals that they all contain.
The stomach acid that we have will dissolve the heavy metals, which is in the clays.
The aluminum itself is released into solution when it hits the strong stomach acid, but they often have other heavy metals besides the aluminum.
I see. Raymond, oh, just like you, Raymond wants to know, my sister is getting chemo for lung cancer. Is there anything that I could recommend her to lessen the nausea? She's not able to eat much and feels pretty badly with the chemo.
The standard thing for the nausea is an anti-serotonin drug. I think cyproheptadine is the most pleasant way to take anti-serotonin drugs, because it comes with antihistamine effects, and those, both anti-serotonin and antihistamines, are also anti-cancer agents. There have been studies using ciproheptadine against various cancers showing positive effects. So I think aspirin and ciproheptadine are generally protective against the toxic effects of chemotherapy.
So the ciproheptadine lowers serotonin and lowers histamine, is also has anti-cancerous effects and helps the nausea?
All of those, yeah.
All of those, wow.
Histamine and serotonin both are powerful things released by cancer, mm-hmm, and stimulating cancer growth.
I see. And the aspirin, you're just talking, taking some aspirin every day, and that's safe. It'll be safe for somebody with that.
It has a very broad spectrum of anti-cancer,
mm-hmm,
effects.
Mm-hmm. Nausea, where's the nausea coming from? The stomach, the body just doesn't like these harsh drugs, and it's just having a hard time dealing with it?
Any kind of injury to the digestive system causes it to produce lots of serotonin. And the serotonin causes the sense of nausea,
mm-hmm,
among other things. And so blocking the serotonin will relieve the nausea.
I see. Okay. Dr. Pete, what exactly is bad about eccentric exercise? ECCENTRIC, eccentric.
It involves extending the muscle against the attempt to contract, and the effect is to cause microscopic tears. Your muscle is trying to go one way, and the force of gravity is forcing it to go to lengthen when it's trying to shorten.
Hmm.
So it tears some of the molecules apart, and that interferes with energy production by the mitochondria. So every time you get a sore muscle from running downhill, you've done some damage to your muscle mitochondria.
Interesting.
And doing only concentric activity, old people have been tested with doing daily concentric contraction against some resistance, and then their mitochondria were sampled, and they had restored effectively younger mitochondria that were able to produce energy.
Okay, so tell folks the difference now. So if we have a barbell, say 20 pounds, and we pull it up, what is that?
That's concentric.
That's concentric. And
if you let it down carefully, that's eccentric.
And the best is?
Concentric.
Concentric.
So the good thing is to lift the barbell and then let it fall to the floor.
Maybe that's why you see some of these weightlifters do that. I wonder if they know about that.
Sure, I think so.
So that, interesting. So if you can do the eccentric and then somehow release the pressure, that's the best. That's cool. That's very cool. Dr. Pete, you've talked about darkness being a stressor. So should we sleep with some kind of light on?
I've tried it, and it tends to be very irritating. I never succeeded in doing it for very long.
Yeah.
But if you have a red light apparatus,
mm-hmm,
and put it on some part of your body where it doesn't bother your eyes, that can have a restorative effect, reducing through your bloodstream, reducing inflammation throughout your body.
Mm-hmm. I was talking with a fellow who's really into red light stuff, Doc, and he suggested in the neighborhood of 600 to 700 or something of these wavelengths of red light, even on your testicles, would increase testosterone levels. Do you think that's possible?
Oh, yeah, definitely possible, but I would just want to be cautious because there hasn't been research showing the safety. There's a possibility that it could stimulate cancer growth as well as production of hormones.
Oh, that wouldn't be good. But so we just don't know with these kind of ideas what they could be doing.
I wouldn't feel secure until I had
seen something.
Good research on it.
To all the guys listening, they like to get these T levels up. Do you have some favorite things you can offer them on this November 16 day of increasing testosterone levels, the good stuff, the stuff that we need to get up and go and lift legs and work?
All of the good anti-inflammatory nutrition principles are going to increase your protective androgens from DHEA to testosterone and dihydrotestosterone. All of those tend to rise when you do an anti-inflammatory, anti-estrogen program.
And folks can Google that and look at that. You're talking anti-inflammatories like things like that? Different
Aspirin, for example.
Aspirin.
The right amount of progesterone and pregnenolone, even though large amounts of progesterone antagonize testosterone, by inhibiting estrogen, the right amount of progesterone can actually increase your testosterone. I've seen it happen in middle-aged men.
And what did they do?
Take a like 5 or 10 milligrams of progesterone, and that lowers the aromatase activity, stops the conversion of testosterone to estrogen, and so it leaves the testosterone that you produce leaves it effective.
Oh, that's why you helped develop the ProGest E product years ago. And that's what that does, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Pete, thank you for continuing to come on Patrick's show. I really enjoy it. Could you ask Dr. Pete why he likes Morton's canning and pickling salt as it reads sodium chloride on the ingredients? I'm simply curious.
Because it doesn't have the toxic additives that regular salt really has.
About all these different sea salts and things like that.
If you look at the ingredients carefully, there are several brands of sea salt that are just as pure, but they're usually 3 or 4 times as expensive as the canning salt.
Yeah. You probably know Dr. Hal Huggins, right? The Mercury Fellow.
Mm-hmm.
We used to have him on quite a bit years ago. A wonderful guy. And he would take all these different blood tests from people, and he was a real, magician at it, and he would, thousands of them, and he claimed that people that did the pickling and canning sea salt had better, he called them blood chemistries, had better blood chemistries than people on sea salt.
That's the effect of the sodium chloride itself. Tom Brewer cited some studies, a book by Shanklin and Hoden gave a lot of the details in which, without changing anything else in the diet, they gave women with serious eclampsia or preeclampsia symptoms, gave them in one case 6 grams extra sodium chloride per day,
mm-hmm.
and in the other, I think it was 20 grams extra per day. And in both cases, that salt alone cured their pregnancy problems. It has wide, very general effects to avoid a sodium chloride deficiency. You're activating the protective oxidative metabolism, suppressing aldosterone, and aldosterone rises in proportion to the lack of sodium chloride, and aldosterone produces inflammation, heart disease, calcification, fibrosis, everything bad produced by aldosterone is suppressed when you get enough sodium chloride.
Interesting. But do not these different fancier ones, you know, the Himalayan and what's the other one from over there in Europe, Celtic sea salt, don't they have enough sodium chloride to be okay?
Very good, except they contain heavy metals.
Heavy metals. They all do.
The discoloration is usually largely from heavy metals.
Oh, so the more white ones, maybe they would be better?
Yeah, the pure white.
Pure white?
That's the thing about pure sea salt and Morton canning salt.
Interesting. Dr. Pete Wayne says, Dr. Warburg stated low oxygen in the cells will result in cancer. What nutrients can I consume to increase the oxygen in my cells as a prevention of cancer?
Warburg's enzyme used vitamin B2 as its cofactor, and he advocated the great importance of getting enough vitamin B2 in your diet. That can momentarily correct the cancer metabolism of overproducing lactic acid. Many other things are needed to change the whole physiology, but vitamin B2 can, when you're overproducing lactate, the B2 can turn it off in a matter of hours.
Hmm.
So that people with redness of the eyes, redness of the nose and cheeks, nosebleeds, memory problems, nightmares, lots of symptoms of a B2 deficiency and lactic acid excess, vasodilation, and weakening of capillaries, that can be corrected. And according to Warburg, that will be a drastic protection against developing cancer.
Fascinating. Robert is in Australia. He's got two questions. One, he's been, at your suggestions, trying some freshly squeezed orange juice and milk, and he gets some headaches, strange noise in his head, and it also happens when he's eating bone broth. So he's been doing some research and thinking it's probably related to histamine intolerance. Can you please ask Dr. Pete what he could do to overcome this problem?
Keeping enough fiber in the diet is one thing.
Fiber?
When you shift to those liquid foods, you're likely not having the same amount of bulk in your diet.
Uh-huh. And
a change in your intestine will invariably increase your serotonin and histamine.
Ah, okay. Can you use these? They got some pretty good, I think, organic even psyllium husk. Is that okay?
Yep.
Okay.
Any kind of fiber that doesn't irritate your intestine. I've seen a couple of people who got constipated from psyllium fiber, but usually it works.
It works okay.
And oatmeal, oat bran, usually is sold with quite a bit of starch attached to it, but the oat bran is a very effective bulk, except in the long run, it can increase your estrogen. Bamboo shoots in excess, they have a slight anti-thyroid effect, but in moderation, they're a very safe fiber. Raw carrots are one of the safest fibers, and well-cooked mushrooms are another cancer-preventive fiber.
And fiber, yeah. You're a big mushroom fan. And, of course, you talk about the raw carrot salad. That's what it's doing, too, is the fiber. Especially if you're going to do more bone broths and milk and orange juice, you need that to move stuff through, huh?
It will, over a period of several days, establish a new rhythm in the intestine, and that reduces estrogen, endotoxin, serotonin, and histamine.
Excellent. Robert in Australia is also taking 3 grains of thyroid, and my temperature has not risen to optimum levels. However, at the same time, my resting heart rate is about 90 to 100 per minute. What could be going on?
That can happen with a selenium deficiency or a calcium deficiency or vitamin D deficiency or some other imbalance of nutrients. So it's good to check what your ratio of calcium to phosphate in the diet is. Too much meat, for example, will interfere with proper thyroid function.
Too much meat. Oh, so that's what you had mentioned last time you were on about even the animals getting lipomas from too much. What's the main ingredient in the meat? Phosphorus.
Phosphorus turns out to be a pretty important toxin, not only in liver or kidney failure, but it generally is a promoter of cancer and degenerative diseases.
So I guess on the animals, the calcium would be bones, why the people recommend giving bones to dogs. Huh? I guess you'd get calcium there.
The carnivores usually eat the smaller, tender bones along with the meat, so they're getting a balance more like milk and cheese.
Mm-hmm. Rhonda is listening. She says, Dr. P, thank you for being on the show with Patrick. Many years ago, Lita Lee, I remember her. She used to talk about your work a lot. I guess she still does. She quoted you as saying, A man blew in the face from lack of oxygen, COPD, and unable to walk was instructed by you to take a pinch of pregnenolone every day, and a couple of weeks later the man was up walking around. Is this accurate story?
Exactly. It was in Toluca, which is very high altitude, and I had known him for 40 years or so. And he didn't recognize me when I came in the room. His attention was affected along with his breathing problem and purple face. But I gave his daughter a batch of pregnenolone and a thyroid powder to add to his food every day. And I went somewhere for 2 weeks and came back later, and he was his normal self. He had his office on an upper floor downtown Toluca, and there were only ramps. And so he took me up to his office. I got winded at the high altitude going up to the third floor, and he was doing fine. He took me all around Toluca visiting various acquaintances and so on, and I was really short of oxygen, but he was absolutely breathing perfectly, from official advanced emphysema to perfect lung function in 2 weeks.
And what do you think happened here? What went on?
That caused me to look up the old literature, and it happened that right about that time I saw a woman, 35 years old, who for 15 years had a terrible oxygenation problem. It started when her father was giving her estrogen injections. He was a doctor and thought women needed estrogen, but her lung oxygenation dropped to about 5% of normal and stayed that way until she 20 years later took adequate thyroid. But looking at the animal research, I saw that that they had created emphysema in various species just with estrogen. A shot of estrogen could decrease oxygenation of the lung by 95% in about an hour after the shot.
Wow.
Same thing that had happened to this woman. And with age, both men and women accumulate more and more estrogen unopposed by progesterone and androgens. There had also been studies of using progesterone in emphysema, curing emphysema just with a few doses of progesterone.
Fascinating. Wow. Amazing.
Those individual studies just didn't catch on and get spread through the culture.
Dr. Ray Peet is November 16, 2020. He's here on the third Monday of the month. We'll talk about the Constitution tomorrow, how it could be affected with the FDA, any kind of vaxes or masking or social distancing, and also some of the election stuff. So it'll be a fun show with Richard Proctor of the Constitutional Party. Ellie wants to know, Dr. Peet, is sesame oil okay to be used on the body? It's recommended for vatas in Ayurvedic medicine.
Internally has too much polyunsaturated fat for regular use. With covering a lot of your skin, you can absorb harmful amounts of the polyunsaturated fats.
Mm-hmm.
But on a small area, it's harmless and mm-hmm. probably beneficial.
Dr. Peet, this is from Peter. I use castor oil a few times a week to keep everything moving down below, if you know what I mean. We do. Do you think there's any downsides to this?
Since it takes itself out as it cleans your intestine, it's very unlikely to have any systemically harmful effects.
Mm-hmm.
Since it's a laxative, it just doesn't get very much absorbed.
Yeah. Please ask Dr. Peet how he avoids scarpinia and what foods keep testosterone levels up after age 65 from Ben.
Sarcopenia?
Sarcopenia. How he avoids sarcopenia, I guess, is the question, and then raising T levels.
Everything anti-inflammatory helps. recently, people have been noticing that the things that lower angiotensin, the ACE inhibitors and angiotensin receptor blockers, the blockers in particular, help to restore muscle mass in old people.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's inflammation developing with the accumulated hormonal changes of aging. Balance shifts towards estrogen, which activates nitric oxide and other pro-inflammatory mediators, causing inflammatory fibrosis and loss of the functional muscle protein.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Peet, this is from Angie. I'm getting some of the Sinoplus from the Mexican pharmacy at your suggestion. It might be worthwhile. Can you tell me how many grains are in these tablets? How many grains? Yeah, she wants to know how they compare to Like Nature Thyroid, which are generally 60 grains, aren't they? Or, I'm sorry, 1 grain or 60 milligrams?
That's a traditional definition, but the natural thyroids have varied greatly. but I consider the Xenoplus to be more or less 2 1/3 to 2.5 grains equivalent. So I recommend starting with no more than 1/4 of a tablet for the first 2 or 3 weeks.
Wow, so each Xenoplus is 2 to what?
2 1/2 grains, roughly.
2 1/2 grains, which is, I guess, 2.5 times 60, right? Milligrams.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty hefty dose. Isn't it?
Yeah. No one starts on that much.
Mm-hmm.
But, traditionally, people would be started on almost always on 1/2 grain.
And then work your way up.
Every 2 weeks, you can add 1/4 to 1/2 grain. Most people ended up needing 2 grains. So that's why the Xenoplus settled in on that dose. That's for an established corrective dose.
About a 2.5, they do.
One pill a day ends up. But you shouldn't try to get there the first week, because it'll, for example, your tissue doesn't retain magnesium effectively when you're low thyroid. And if you take a big dose of thyroid suddenly, there's not enough magnesium for the demand. And so it can cause a vasoconstriction in your heart and cause pains and so on.
Yeah. So, and the metrics you're using when you say when you have the right amount would be the body temperature, the pulse, and the you've talked about the knee or the ankle thing where you're hitting the Achilles tendon as well.
It's the relaxation rate that you look for in that Achilles reflex test.
Yeah, and then also the body temp. And
pulse rate, and quality of sleep.
Quality of sleep.
The depth of your sleep should increase very quickly when you correct the thyroid. It's the same relaxation principle in your brain as in your ankle.
In your ankle.
Tendon reflex. It should relax instantly when you're not needing it. So when you start trying to go to sleep, your brain should turn off as quickly as your foot relaxes.
And if your foot doesn't relax, then you just keep taking it until the body figures it out? I mean, how much you need?
Using the quick-acting T3, I've seen people whose foot took about 2 seconds to return to the relaxed position.
That's the product from the same place, Doc. What's the name of that one?
Xenomel.
Xenomel. And that's just T3. And you've actually seen the relaxation thing just do quickly.
I think it was 10 micrograms I gave this person who had a very, very slow relaxation. And an hour later, when we tried it, it was a normal, quick, floppy relaxation.
I'll be.
And you can get quick results against insomnia the same way.
Just by trying with a little T3 before bed?
I noticed it in myself, and a doctor in Nevada said he hadn't been able to sleep for 3 or 4 nights and was desperate.
Right.
And I had some Xenomel in my pocket. I told him to take 10 micrograms, and next day, he pulled me aside and said, that stuff's better than morphine.
I'll be. And how many micrograms are in one of those Xenomels?
25.
Oh, so you're about 1/2 or so, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Very interesting. So if you did that, which is interesting, a great story, is it going to help the thyroid to be better each day, or do you have to keep doing it? How does that work?
I've seen just 2 or 3 people who cured their hypothyroidism by supplementing for just a few days. It broke them out of a stress that was inhibiting their thyroid.
Mm-hmm.
But usually, if a person is overweight, the thyroid will help you get rid of the estrogen-producing fat and polyunsaturated fats in storage. And once you've got those eliminated, which typically takes from 2 to 5 years, then your thyroid can function normally with a good diet.
Interesting. Very good. A couple more, then we'll let you go. People on YouTube are claiming Mexican Coca-Cola on YouTube contains high fructose corn syrup, just like the American Coke. It's just Coca-Cola pandering on two separate markets. Do you think that's true?
Hmm. I heard that story from someone working at the Pepsi-Cola company in Mexico, that they were using invert sugar, but not the claim that they were using the corn syrup. I hadn't heard that claim before.
Yeah, I haven't either. Why does Dr. Pete think that distilled water could be cancer-causing? I heard him say that a few times from Naomi.
That was just tests demonstrating that any irritation will release histamine and serotonin and other inflammatory mediators and will be carcinogenic.
And I see.
That was involving injecting distilled water.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Is it safe to take aspirin to help with pain and discomfort, breastfeeding? C-section last week. Could there be anything to eat, drink, supplements to help with milk production? So, okay, C-section last week. Safe to take some aspirin to help with pain and discomfort and breastfeeding?
I think it's safe if your vitamin K level is adequate. I would start supplementing some vitamin K and make sure your clotting system is good.
I see. And to increase milk production, have you came across things over the years that'll do that?
Drinking orange juice and milk.
Orange juice and milk.
I've seen non-producers get their normal milk production up if they drank a quart of orange juice for a day or two.
Interesting. Back in the hippie days, Dr. Pete, we used to talk about, I don't know if it was true, I do remember for breastfeeding moms to increase milk production was actually a natural kind of a full-bodied beer. I wonder where that came from. Do you think there's anything to that?
It's an old practice.
Ah.
Partly the idea was that it contains estrogen.
Ah, could be something to... Okay, here's the final one for you, and then every now and then I get kind of swollen feet, not terrible, but it's some kind of edema. What could be my body be telling me to look for to balance out?
It could be a salt or calcium deficiency or low thyroid.
Either one, or all three.
Mm-hmm. Or low protein.
Or low protein. In general, before we go on this thyroid thing, whether you're doing Sinoplus or experiment around with Natrathroid, can we get to a point, do you think, where we can just help this thyroid be okay on its own, or do we just mind taking some of the pig stuff or whatever we're going to take for the rest of our life? I mean, does it matter to you?
By the time you're 45 or 50, that there are so many accumulated problems that it's fairly...
Yeah, what's the difference, right? Take a little pig thyroid.
It's fairly rare that a person doesn't benefit from a little thyroid after the age of 50.
Yeah. I mean, there's no real downsides, is there?
No.
No real downsides. Well, my friend, thank you for being here. So you're not into the city of Portland where people are being silly. So you're outside there and taking care of yourself, right?
Yep, nothing happening here.
Yeah, Do you see any, I know you kind of study this stuff, do you think that we're going to be experiencing possible some food shortages? Have you looked at that?
The World Economic Forum is, I think, intent on disrupting the economy.
Yeah.
At the point of creating food shortages so that they can institute their changes. If you Google Klaus Schwab, World Economic...
Oh, yeah, we know him. All right.
Yeah, you'll find some really horrible plans they're putting out and instituting, putting into practice.
They're not secret about it either, are they? It seems like they just put it out there.
Yep. Starting with the Rockefeller Foundation, right. 10 years ago, they've put out the scenarios of taking over the world.
We're hearing some pretty spooky things, excuse me, about this potential vaccine. Dr. Seneff has been working on it from MIT. We're going to have her on. Have you heard anything or seen anything that disturbs you?
Anything that what?
Into this potential vaccine that's coming out.
All of the above? They're proposing putting lots of horrible things in.
Yeah.
Tracking devices.
I've heard that. Wow, man. So we just got to figure out how not to take this guy, right? Even if somebody tells us to.
Yeah, and they're telling people to take a flu shot, even if they can't get the corona. But several studies show that people who took a flu shot last season were several times more likely to develop a coronavirus infection this season.
Yes.
Showing that they destroy the immune system, even though they produce antibodies against influenza, they weaken the innate immunity.
We appear to be making some headways, though, in the courts, and I know you've talked about this and on your website, but I know that there was a big victory in California where a couple of attorneys took Governor Newsom to court and said he didn't have the authority to do all this stuff he was doing, and they won, you know. So, you know, there's some things going on that are a positive in that regard.
Several lawyers, people you've had on
yes,
the program,
sir. Yes, sir.
Are working through the court, so I think there's hope that way.
Yeah. I don't know if they really get hardcore, Dr. Pete, with this vaccine thing. It may be a Supreme Court one, huh? Could be.
And I hope the composition of the Supreme Court recognizes some kind of constitutional.
Well, you hope so. I think theoretically there's 5-4 more constitutionalists, but this Chief Justice guy fellow, I don't know what he's been. I think he needs some orange juice, Dr. Pete, because he's ruled some pretty silly rulings, in my opinion, in the last few months, Roberts.
There's a competition between authoritarianism and constitutionalism.
Yes. Oh, that's the other word, authoritarianism. Well, Dr. Pete, you take care of yourself. We'll see you in a month or so, I guess before Christmas. So
okay.
You have
very
fun.
Good.
Thanks for everything. We really appreciate your being here, sir. It's an honor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Dr. Ray Pete, Patrick Timpone, OneRadioNetwork.com. Yeah, boy, I tell you, having some fun now, aren't we? We are having some fun now. Well, we're trying to stay on top of everything that we can as best we can. I think you're going to hear from a few people this week. We have a constitutional fellow scheduled for tomorrow, I think 11 o'clock Central Time. But it doesn't matter exactly when we put it out there live. He'll be live. I think his internet is solid. Just tune into our website. Please sign up for our newsletter. And Sharon sent some cool things out a few times a week. It'll keep you up to date with all the people we're having on. Don't forget our archives now. We have an incredible suite of shows, probably 3,000 hours of audio shows on One Radio Network. And so use our search function there at the top right. Use it if you want to. You'll find people going back, 12, 13, 14, 15 years. Some really good stuff. Most of this you know, if we find people with some good information, it doesn't go out of date. So even if the show was 10 years ago, you're going to be able to find some things that may help you. So we have a nice search function. You could put in people's names, put in things like low thyroid, high thyroid, whatever. And then also go on to our YouTube channel, Patrick Timpone, and then subscribe to our channel. Click on the bell to the right. It says the subscribe button, and that'll get you subscribed up and be notified when we put out the streams. We have a timeout in Facebook, so I haven't been able to be there. Won't be there for a few more days, and we're looking at some other social media things that are less whatever. I don't need any more Zuckerberg karma, so I'm just being nice. So keep in touch. Let me know if I can help with anything. My name is Patrick Timpone. I love you all very much. Thank you. And thanks for your ongoing support. It's an honor to be here. And we will see you very soon on OneRadioNetwork.com.
We are listener supported. One Radio Network.